All right, good morning. This podcast is brought to you by HTS. HTS is your local technology expert, serving Delaware for 16 years. HTS specializes in TV installations, home automations, Sonos audio systems, security cameras, and Wi-Fi networks. For all of your home and business tech needs, give them a call, 1-800-690-2029, or visit them at htsav.net. All right, good morning and welcome back. This is the Rehoboth Social Podcast, part of the Social Podcast Network, www.socialpodcastnetwork.com. Local folks doing local podcasts. Good morning. Good morning. How are you?
I am so good. How are you?
I'm fantastic. What do we got? 3 days?
3 days.
To the big man shows.
Three days.
If that's on your thing. If not, well, then it's just a winter celebration.
I work in the restaurant industry, so Christmas is one of the most stressful times of the year. But as soon as I had a wife and kids,
yeah,
it had a whole new meaning. And I do appreciate it, and I take it for like the small things. Yeah. The time I get to spend with my family, I make sure that I wake up and take my time.
Yeah.
I drink really good coffee.
There you go.
I laugh at my wife, who will spend the entirety of the day in her bathrobe and pajamas.
Oh, my.
No matter where we go.
So it's not just my wife.
Yeah.
Because I thought maybe my wife was broken.
my wife's bathrobe is more like a cape, and she celebrates life in it.
It's so funny how, and I can speak for my wife at least, but you know how when you end up meeting your wife, you know, your partner, and, you know, and there's this kind of, this whole kind of, I don't want to say an act, but, you know, yeah, this act sort of that goes on. And then once you're locked in, right, once you sign the contract and you're in, then the real partner shows up.
Oh, yeah.
My wife is, you know, if she had her way, we would basically, she's a homebody. She loves to be at home. She doesn't really find being out a big fan of that. And she likes to be home with family. And, you know, I mean, it's good. I love it. But I just didn't expect that.
For sure.
It's a safe spot.
I love my wife because she is face value. I mean, you know what you get. She may have suckered me in a little bit. She's a Sussex County girl, and you know, I didn't know all that much about Sussex County when I first moved down here. But she is still just as amazing as the day I met her.
That's probably a whole nother podcast, is figuring out Sussex County women. Because my wife actually moved down here from New York, so I won't put that on her. I'm not even. Okay. I always say, if you're from Sussex County, you probably move away.
Yeah,
right.
And a lot of people, but some really stay. I mean, you know, her dad's into politics, and he was a farmer and a school teacher around here for a very long time, and she loves it here. Her friends are here. Her family's here. She's worked at Quiet Storm for 22 years.
Wow.
She's vested.
She's in. Well, listen, Matt Kern, I had you and Helen Riley.
Mm-hmm.
I get hesitant when I say the last name because I get nervous if I'm going to say it wrong. But I think
she will let you know.
She will let you know.
She may call any minute.
There may be a phone call, right. But I would say Riley is fair to say from the Story Hill Farm.
Yep.
And you guys, pull that mic a little bit closer. You guys, what was it called? Graze
to pasture.
Graze to pasture. And but you know, kind of a spin on the whole kind of eating in the middle of the farm.
For sure.
And I love those things. I think it's great. It was great to have you guys on that day. And I thought, and I after the podcast, I'm like, hey Matt, I'd love to have you on just by yourself. And you know, we love Helen, but you know, I think you have a great story. My after I posted that podcast, I've had several people reach out, one of them being my friend Ashley from Visit Rehoboth, and she's like, you never even asked him about being a James Beard nominee. And I was like, whoops. You know, I got caught up in the whole other story. and I forgot to talk about that. So I thought it'd be fun to have you on and just listen, learn about your story and the James Beard Award nominee. Because that's almost like, it's such a hard nomination, right? Or to win that.
It's not, I mean, there are a lot of chefs that can bring ruin to their career by trying to get one of these.
Right.
I kind of did it by accident.
Well, I would imagine that that's probably the best way to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I always think about like the Michelin stars, right? Mm-hmm. When these, you know, remember the movie Burnt? I love that movie.
Oh, yeah.
And then that movie reminded me, and you were friends with Matt,
yep,
our buddy Matt Haley, who won, he won the actual James Beard Humanitarian of the Year award, so which is a huge deal. What could you have a crazier story, right? Win and then pass on. It's like,
I know,
the top of his game.
I feel like, you know, I didn't know Matt nearly as well as a lot of other people. I did work for him. We butted heads. We definitely had our differences, but you respect him for who he is, for his story, for what's in his heart. I think the greatest testament to Matt's story is that if you asked him how he wanted to go, he would have told you exactly how he did.
Yeah.
And I'd hats off to him. Yeah. I mean, he did what he said he was going to do. He did a lot more things, and he has a legacy behind him.
Yeah. Well, we miss him. Sometimes I feel like it's fading, and I get a little annoyed because I feel like it shouldn't. But, you know, time moves on. You know, we play our role and we do our thing and then we move on and the rest of the world keeps moving along. And you gotta kind of watch it do what it is. I definitely miss that guy. But, I think it's great to have another Matt who is alive and who was nominated. But, you know, it's also, you know, and I like when you said that, you know, I didn't make a lot of effort. It just happened.
There was a lot of effort, but I wasn't pushing for that. And I'd like to believe that we got nominated for the right reasons.
Well, I didn't mean that there wasn't effort, because I clearly know there's a lot of work, because I'm just saying it wasn't like on your, this is what we got to do.
I didn't think it was on my radar. I didn't think it was possible, and I didn't think it was something attainable. And when it happened, I'm going to be honest with you, you know, Meg Lee and I were trying to get into the Beard House to do a dinner. And you know, that's all on you. Like you have to get all the vendors and companies you're going to use to donate this money and this food for you to go there so that you can put on this dinner.
Can we explain how this whole James Beard thing works? Because I've heard about the house, the James Beard House. I've heard about the dinners.
Yeah.
I've heard, you know, different things. I don't really know quite honestly what the hell's going on.
I mean, a lot of it is a mystery. I know that.
Who was James Beard?
James Beard.
Let's start with that.
Was a pretty incredible man who was a chef, and he lived in New York with his boyfriend in this house. He got to cook with all the famous people, but he cooked food from his heart, and most of it was very French or Spanish based. You know, he was like a Matt Haley.
Yeah,
like he was just alive and charged. And wanted to bring this common sense of food and camaraderie and home, you know, to the public. He wanted everybody to be able to sit and dine together and eat well. I mean, I remember being in my grandmother's kitchen, and she had a black and white TV, and it was James Beard and Julia Child on TV. I remember that day.
Wow.
So when I went to the Beard House, it was so crazy to see this kitchen, which is really tiny, and I'm an ogre of a man. You know, when you're 9'17", it's
7'5".
I went into this kitchen, and they're like, "Oh my God, are you going to be okay to cook?" I was like, "I got this," but I was with my team.
So how does that work? So if you're invited to come, so is there different levels of invited?
To the dinner is far different from being nominated for a Beard Award.
Okay,
we just wanted to do a dinner, just to be on James Beard's radar. So I'm going to be honest, I didn't know much until we got the nomination. I really had to start digging deep. Meg Lee called me, and it was February, and it was right before my birthday. And she's like, "Are you sitting down now?" I was on the toilet.
Oh,
I couldn't exaggerate. I'm not lying.
Makes
sense. I was sitting on the toilet. I had done run around some errands, drank a bunch of coffee. It was my time of the day.
Sure. Happens.
I said, "Why, yes, I am sitting down." And she said, "You were nominated for a James Beard." And in my mind, I knew we were already trying to do a dinner there, and we didn't hear back. And I was like, "Wait, we got it? We're going to do the dinner?" She's like, "No, stupid. You got nominated for a Beard Award." I was like, "What?" She said, "Best Chef Mid-Atlantic." And I stopped.
So how does this... You know, because I've watched, like, you know, I mentioned Burnt. I've watched some movies about, like, Michelin stars. I've watched kitchens go through this process and trying to understand when the Michelin judges come through, what's some typical things, like in the movie Burnt, I think they really show how that really works.
For sure.
And I love, you know, how the napkin gets dropped. You know, it's usually, you know, two people. They probably send back a fork. Yeah. You know, there's these little things that go on. So
There's fiction to some of that, but there's some real world assets too. For Michelin to even come to your town, it's got to be a city. It's got to be a major city, and they have to pay money to get you there. I mean, DC just spent like $250,000 to get Michelin to come to DC just to start rating restaurants a few years ago. New York, they paid years ago. San Francisco, same. I don't know if Delaware is ever going to be on their map. I mean, it took Innit Little Washington next to 15 years to finally get recognition.
We're going to stick on our topic, but I just read this article about this a review of a restaurant that was a Michelin star review or Michelin star restaurant that it was awful.
Yeah.
Did you see that? It was
a lot. I mean, every restaurant is going to, you know, fail somebody.
Well, I think this restaurant has gotten so sophisticated, so arrogant almost, so to speak, that the food, they've completely, you know, when they're, you know, were they adding flavor to vapor, you know, smoke, you know, this, they wrote that they had seven meals and not one of them required any chewing, I think. That it was just, you know, how, I guess that's for another, a whole other podcast. Yeah, but
that's not really a meal to me, but.
No, give me a good steak, nice baked potato, or, you know, something of a sort. So how does this James Beard thing get going? How do you even end up on the radar of those folks?
Just normal people like you and me have to be prevalent and know about the James Beard Association. Every October, they have open enrollment, and that's where all the people of the country can vote for their favorite chef, their favorite restaurant, their favorite cookbook on the James Beard website, and then they tally these numbers and they find the top 20 in each category in each region.
Okay.
We are part of the Mid-Atlantic. We're up against, you know, D.C., Philly, that's Virginia and Maryland and Pennsylvania and New Jersey. And there's a lot of heavy hitters. So if you're nominated as one of the top 20 chefs in your area or your region, it's definitely like getting nominated for an Oscar. It's huge. And
so when someone nominates you, it can also be based on just what, like, a good guy you are.
For sure.
It doesn't have to be.
The idea behind a James Beard nomination, especially for a chef anyway, is that you are pushing some of the boundaries and grounds of cuisine. You are representing your area honestly and wholeheartedly. And you are also invested in
community.
So
you're probably a decent guy.
I hope so.
Not you, man. I'm just saying in general.
But in general, yes.
I know you're a great guy. I'm just saying. I guess because, you know, you look at the Michelin star, and that is like, you know, that's a team, right? That is a restaurant. That is, I mean, it can be a year.
It's process, based off of decadence.
Right. But it's a lot, you know, it's how everything kind of falls together where,
for sure,
you know, if you're picking, you know, if I'm going to have somebody on my podcast, and I'm not comparing myself, but I'm just saying when I think, you know, I'm interested in your story. I'm interested in what you do. And are you a pretty decent guy?
Yeah.
You know, and that's kind of, so I'm nominating you right now.
Yes.
You are nominated again.
Thanks, man.
But, you know, so it's a lot of other stuff besides just being awesome at food.
I mean,
it's kind of better, right?
Oh, yeah.
Michelin star.
For sure.
Okay.
But any chef, any chef that gets nominated for either a Michelin star or a James Beard Award, you have a solid team behind you.
Yeah.
At Heirloom, I had, you know, seven kids at sometimes that dedicated everything to me and to Megan Lee and our story. I mean, they came in, they worked six, sometimes 7 days a week, long hours. We worked 10, 12 hours a day, you know, put up with my shit, which
I love a kitchen.
Yeah, oh yeah.
I freaking love
it. It's
a kitchen,
pirate
man.
Shit.
I love it's that's I'm not in the I'm not in that business, but if I wasn't in the business, I'm in the hair business. It's like the hair kind of kitchen business.
For sure.
It's this
very,
you know,
similar.
Grind. Yeah, and if I wasn't working in what I was doing, I'd be in the restaurant business because I love it's like fucking group of pirates, man.
For sure.
And when it is running well, And I'll use just for like a Gordon Ramsay, you know, or early Gordon Ramsay, you know, those old Kitchen Nightmare shows where they didn't realize he was it was so popular to be an asshole, right? Yeah. When he was just this guy, but he had a lot of requirements and he asked a lot of his crew, but when they ran like 100%, it was beautiful.
A symphony.
Oh my God. And I get emotional when I watch that stuff. And
it's controlled chaos.
Yeah. And I used to love, like, I would go over to Matt's and be like, sit down, grab a seat. And I go, you know, and this is at his house. I'm like, okay. And he'd be like in the freaking, and I used to love, you pull out a drawer and it was just silverware.
Yeah.
There was no separate for knives. It was a pile of silverware. Yep. You know, they were clean, but they were just all in there. And I love that. And he used to just make shit. And I'd be like, what are you making? He said, don't worry about it. And you put it down and you just start eating. And it was good. And you know that he thought through it. And it was special to him, which made it special to me. And I just love that relationship with a chef, food, and the customer. It's awesome. Lucky you, man.
Hey, you Jelly. Are transferring energy from one living thing to another.
I'm a chef. I got one set. And it's my kids.
Yeah.
And my wife.
Hey.
You know, and I loved, like this morning, I got these amazing avocados over at BJ's on this weekend. They all ripened out today.
Yeah.
And I cut them and they're beautiful. I'm like,
perfect.
David, salt and pepper, a little lemon, just eat it. He's like, okay. He's like, all right, that was good. It's good food. Oh, feeding your kids doesn't get any better. I love it. Sorry. Go ahead.
So once they tally all the numbers of the people nominated for this thing, then they pick your top 20 and they announce it. So from there, they have to pick the top 5. That is only allowed James Beard winners or people on their voting team, which is usually around 250 to 280 members from what I understand. Mm. And they go around secretively under the radar and test your food. They eat your food, they dine, they want a regular experience, and you better not disappoint, and you have no idea they're there, which means that everyone who walks through that door is just as important as a James Beard judge. Right. Do you know what I mean? Everyone. Yeah. I mean, you should already look at that from the gate, that every customer you have, you are looking to accommodate and appease and make feel like they're at your home.
Yeah, makes sense. I mean, I think as a chef, you probably do that anyway.
For sure, but that's where the team comes in.
Right.
I cannot execute dinners for 76 people a night on my own, let alone dinners that have all these components and structure and placement and perfect flavor and taste involved, and getting those ingredients from local sources and farms and having to clean them and structure them and cook them and process them.
So is there any idea when these folks may be coming through? Is there a James Beard judging season?
There are restaurants and people that know when to look for New York numbers, Boston numbers, Philadelphia numbers. If you've won a James Beard Award in the past for anything from media to cookbooks to chef, you can now openly vote for these top 5 of the top 20.
I wish that, obviously we wish that Matt hadn't died, but I wish he'd have been alive to be like, you know, the James Beard winner,
for sure.
Like for a few years. I wish he'd had that. I would have loved to have seen him kind of grow from that. I feel like that was going to be really the beginning of something really cool.
Yeah.
And, you know, he won the Humanitarian of the Year. So I don't know what that entails.
I mean, it does entail a great deal of donating money and time and just showing up.
Yeah.
You know, Jose Andreas is one of my heroes in life. And he won the Humanitarian Award. And then he used that platform to get a ton of people to donate money so he could open up World Central Kitchen. And now he goes to every major disaster all across the planet with a whole team of people and food, and he cooks for these people.
Did you start off wanting to be a chef? Or, you know, I loved when, you know, Matt used to talk about how, you know, he struggled. He bounced around a bit. And then, you know, the restaurant industry was the only industry that opened its arms to him and took him in. And raised him in a sense, and taught him how to be, you know, the person that he ended up being, and Is that how you kind of ended up, or what was your...
The restaurant industry is a home for all of God's unwanted children.
Yeah, it is. We'll take you.
To be honest, I was an artist, and I was supposed to be a musician. That's what I thought my full-time job...
I was supposed
job,
to be Eddie Van Halen, but I missed that.
I was supposed to be the next Stevie Ray Vaughan, that didn't happen.
So you became a chef.
Well, I was working in restaurants since I was 14. Mm. And without even trying, I had gotten into some of the best restaurants I could in my town at that time. So I think the level of great cuisine and discipline was instilled in me in a young age. So even when I was paying rent and working in a restaurant, you know, and then trying to get gigs, trying to set up platforms where my band could practice and play shows and make T-shirts and flyers. I mean, I took this stuff so seriously because I legitimately thought I could be a musician for a living.
Yeah.
I wanted it. And the whole time I was paying my rent by working in a restaurant.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, great, my bar tab would get paid, but it was restaurants that were paying my rent and buying me groceries and helping me survive. And I think, you know, I worked at a couple key places that I worked under great chefs, and they took me under their wing and they taught me things that I really respected and appreciated. And for me, I needed that. I needed that discipline. I didn't go to college. I couldn't afford it. And a restaurant was this access to a life that I couldn't afford, to appreciate ingredients that I couldn't just purchase on my own. And there was this just certain special morale that was in a kitchen. You know, it lures you in. And I worked with a bunch of miscreants of all color, creed, and nationality, and we were all shoulder to shoulder in the trenches, you know, battling to keep our heads above water. I mean,
do you believe you really? I mean, it's about coming up through the kitchen. You know,
there's ranks.
Yeah, the ranks. I love.
It's very militant.
And I'll probably always refer to this Burnt movie because I thought it was so good. And I know that it's a movie, but you know, he fucked up his life and then he ended up having to shuck oysters.
Yeah.
And he had to shuck a million oysters and he wrote it down.
That was his penance.
And he wrote it down and he shucked them all. And then when he was done, he was done. And he
dropped the knife and took off.
You know, you'll see people, I know even in every industry, right? I mean, you always want to be at the top quick, right? You never want to do the grind.
Yeah.
You know, I remember when I became a hairdresser and Drexel, who I love, he used to say, listen, you know, charge for the color and give away the haircuts.
Yeah.
You know, you can give away your time. You can't give away my money.
Yeah.
You know, meaning don't charge for the money that it costs for me to color their hair. But as far as the cut, you can donate it. That's how you get better. Mm-hmm. And I remember I was like, okay. And so, and Matt used to come in and I used to cut his hair for free. And I used to charge for the color. Because to make sure that Drexel was covered, but the cut I did for free. And I did that a lot. And I built a book and, you know, I grinded through it. And as I came up, I would tell people, new people to the business, I say, listen, give away your cuts. You know, do the color, you know, make sure the salon gets paid for that. But they're like, oh, I don't know if I want to do that.
Yeah.
It's like,
well.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, there's something about that. There's some suffering that needs to happen.
If you're not willing to wash dishes, if you're not willing to break down boxes, take out trash, scrub the floor, get on your hands and knees, organize a walk-in, clean out a lowboy, get your ass handed to you uncomfortably, then you should not do this. And I don't care how much your culinary education cost, that doesn't mean you belong in the restaurant industry.
Well, and I think even when you're in the restaurant, even at the where you're at, I mean, you know, listen, if you got to wash some dishes, that ain't a thing.
No.
I mean, I personally, if you call me and say, Tom, I need you to come down here and help us tonight wash dishes, I'd be like, hell yes. I love that stuff.
Yeah.
I love to volunteer. Like, I don't want to be your dishwasher.
Yeah.
But if you needed help one night,
that'd be
oh,
awesome.
My God, damn right.
I mean, the dishwasher is just as important as every other human body in that restaurant.
It's almost the most important.
It is.
Dude, without any clean dishes, you have what?
And perfect glassware and scrubbed pans and properly cleaned and organized kitchen.
Dishes, no dinner.
Yeah, man. That's, you know, the weakest, there's no weak link. And if one fails, we all fail.
Dude, you could put the most delicious, amazing looking dinner on a plate. And if that plate is dirty,
yep, it's all worth nothing.
It was fucking, there it all, it just went out the window.
Yep.
I always say, I could do the most amazing haircut. All the wife is going to notice is that I missed a hair in her husband's ear.
Yeah.
Right? It's like one hair, the haircut's shit, everything's yep. shit. I'm like, damn it, if I could just cut that last hair. But that's the fun part, man. That's the part that, you know, keeps you getting up every day. Oh, yeah, right?
For sure. For sure. You never stop learning. You know, I'm grateful because my brain is not formatted for school. It's definitely not formatted for college. It is formatted in more learning and chaos. I thrive in chaos. I really do. When crap hits the fan, I can slow things down in my brain and systematically pick at the things that I have to first. And I don't know why.
Right.
It's times of comfort that drive me insane. And maybe that's my ADHD. Maybe it's just...
It's times of comfort that drive you insane?
Yeah, sometimes.
I always say I'm not living unless I'm suffering.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm not suffering and grinding, I'm not living.
Yeah.
I'm taken.
Yep.
Right? And when you're comfortable, you're just taken.
Yeah.
No, I'm just taken. I'm not speaking for you, but I get that. I mean, you know, when you're in the shit... That's when you're thriving, man.
Yeah.
The heart's beating, your eyes are open, you're aware. That's the best time, I think, in life.
It's like this orchestrated dance in a kitchen, especially when everything is just cranking the way it's supposed to. You feel like you're a part of a song.
Well, I feel like we've gotten away from that.
Yeah.
In general.
Yeah. We've standardized restaurants and we've standardized menus and we've, you know, tried to standardize the way of operating a restaurant. It's only the true rebels that walk alone.
Well, we live in a unique space here.
We do.
We are, I call this like the Disneyland of restaurants, sort of, because, you know, we live in a destination.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you went, I just had a client the other day that she's been to every state, right? And she had 5 states left. And during the summer, her and her friend, they went and visited the last 5.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, in whether it's what's going on or just where we are in this country, but she said all 5 of the states, there were no restaurants. There was like, you know, an Applebee's. There was corporate restaurants, but there was nothing like what we have here today.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if we didn't have the beach, if we didn't have this as a destination, you know, it may not be as easy to just fire up some kick-ass cool restaurant, you know, unless you got a ton of people coming here.
I mean,
might not be the same out in the middle of the country as it is here along the East Coast.
Well, you need some good competition. I mean, after the past couple of years, I don't want really any competition. I want to see all restaurants bring money to the table and succeed. I really do.
Well, is it competition or inspiration?
I think it's both. I'm not a competitive person.
Right.
Especially when I was living in the city, you know, you work at these great restaurants and then you look at these other great restaurants and you have friends in those restaurants working. Like, you only want to see everyone do well.
Cooperation over competition.
For sure.
That was a big, you know, Matt was that way as well.
And if everybody's doing something different, it makes life even better. You know, it makes it tastier. It makes you more of a place that all people want to visit.
Yeah.
So I think if we could get away from some of the sameness that we have around here and look at the restaurants that are really, you know, doing something great and putting everything they have into it, like, we're doing a pretty good job.
Right.
There's a lot of really talented chefs around here that I really respect. And there's a lot of restaurants that I like eating at, you know, of all different scales of your financial out.
How do you balance between obviously the, you know, because when people come here, what do they want? Crab cakes, fish and chips.
I mean,
ribs.
A lot of them, but there's a lot of other people. We have the DC, the Philadelphia, and the New York crowd that does have more of a sophisticated palate, and they are looking for something different.
So how do you do that? I mean, is it in cuts? Is it in portions? Is it in, because you know, I remember once going to it was Matt's Fish Camp, and they had yellow perch. And I'm like, I've never even seen yellow perch on the menu. I'm like, well, I'm going to have that.
Yeah.
I probably wouldn't have usually, but I was like, you know what? I'm going to just try it. It's on the specials.
Mm-hmm.
It was amazing. But, you know, do you invest a whole lot of money into a bunch of yellow perch? Because maybe, you know, I did it just because I was wild that night, right?
Yeah.
But could that have been a failure? It's tough, right?
I mean,
to be edgy and...
You're always going to look For me, it's more about seasonality. So part of my job is done for me. I work with as many local farms that I possibly can. Sometimes I even drive to the farm to be able to pick up the ingredients so the farmer doesn't have to leave, because sometimes it's a real hassle. So when I'm writing menus, when I'm building what we're going to serve in the restaurant, when I'm putting specials together, it is all based off of what these farms have. And then I fill in the blocks with some other stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I work with a few different seafood mongers, if you will, so that I can get as localized fish as possible.
Hmm.
I'm trying to represent an area. If we're the Mid-Atlantic and we're smack dab in the middle of it, I want to show the fish that swim in our water, the food that grows in our fields.
Rockfish. Sorry.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I have rockfish on the menu right now just because they're catching it around here.
Yeah, and it's good. It's a big fish.
It's a fish. It is fish.
That's a fish right there.
Yeah.
No way around that one. That's absolutely a fish. What is it? Sea bass? Is that what they call those?
Well, it's a striped bass.
Striped bass. Okay.
The only reason it's called rockfish is because in Jersey, striped bass fishing was excommunicated for certain times of the year, and you couldn't serve it on your menu. But that's all they were catching. They could catch it in plenty.
So they changed the name?
So they changed the name to rockfish.
Okay.
And then it was adopted by a lot of the East Coast, but rockfish started out as striped bass.
I thought it had a... I was like, I think this has a different name. But...
Well, even still in Jersey, you can't put rockfish or striped bass on your menu certain times of the year.
So, and I guess that's kind of what I'm talking about. You kind of have, you know, listen, you want to be, you know, you want to get out of the box, right? Mm-hmm. But if that's all they're catching is rockfish...
That's like, what's going on the menu.
Yeah, it's tough.
I mean, I love sugar toads. Sugar toads are these little non-poisonous.
Okay, I've never heard of that.
They're these little non-poisonous blowfish that swim in our waters all over the place, and they're caught as a bycatch all the time. And you catch them, so if you fillet them, you get this beautiful little chicken wing of a chunk of meat with the spine down the middle that you can batter and deep fry, and it is delectable. I mean, I could eat about 30 or 40 of them.
Wow.
So
are those on the menu?
Yeah.
Okay.
If you
real quick, where are you at? Because we know you're not at Ireland.
One coastal in Fenwick Island.
One coastal in Fenwick Island. All right. I might have to try these.
I hope you do. I'll let you know when I have them on the menu.
Yeah, this sounds fun. If it's a special, I'll try it.
For sure. For sure.
So that's a good solution.
Yeah.
What are they called again? Sugar toads?
Sugar toads. We also like to put the Chesapeake blue catfish on our menu a lot. Now, when people think of catfish, they think, it's muddy, it's gross. The Chesapeake blue catfish is an invasive species. It's eaten up over 40% of the indigenous wildlife in the Chesapeake. It lives in one of the most pristine aquacultured lands that we have. So it's not living in this disgusting, gross pond. It's living in a watershed that is filled with crab and rockfish spawn and clams, and they're eating better than we are, and they're eating all of our stuff.
Why can't we use catfish for fish and chips?
We can.
Because I always see catfish...
as like, cod.
Well, I like cod as fish and chips. It seems like anytime I get catfish, it's more of a meal
mm-hmm.
battery kind of breading.
For sure.
Why?
Just, I think people identify catfish as being dredged in cornmeal and deep fried.
So
I mean,
I do it.
I'm you know, caught red-handed because I definitely try to use the best cornmeal I can from Castle Valley Mills or from Anson Mills, and I dredge this beautiful catfish in cornmeal and I deep fry it.
Well, I'll keep this anonymous.
But you can also steam it. You can sear it.
Well, catfish, I think, is delicious.
Oh, yeah.
It's an amazing fish.
For sure.
I don't like it dredged in cornmeal. But the only reason I don't like it because it was sold as a fish and chips.
Yeah.
And when I think fish and chips, I think of like a vinegar. I like vinegar. Cornmeal and vinegar, they don't work very well. So
they
I'm
clash.
Not saying that, it, you know, there's a problem. I'm just asking, trying to figure out why are we limiting catfish to cornmeal dredges?
I think that's just kind of a we can right away.
No, stop. I ain't gonna be responsible for screwing up the damn cornmeal dredges.
Well, I don't even have it on my menu at this point.
But
right
I'm just
now,
wondering because I think that if you don't like cornmeal dredges, you're pretty much out of catfish. You're out of the catfish group, and I think catfish is a pretty delicious fish. So
for sure.
I was just wondering, maybe we could hit it with some of that beer batter.
Yeah,
beer battered catfish, and see what happens.
You can do it.
Okay. I feel like I'm now going to be nominated.
Personally, I think, taking like a Thai cooking style to it or a Malaysian cooking style to it is even better. They wrap it up in a banana leaf and steam it with coconut milk and curry. And
oh, that sounds good.
It's amazing.
That's
my mouth is watering right now.
Catfish is a nice, firm fish.
It is.
It's ugly.
It is.
But it is a delicious
And the
fish.
Catfish they're catching out of the Chesapeake are like 6 to 7 feet long. And the flesh is so clean and white, you could eat it as sashimi.
That's nice.
And the only predator they have is man. So
you
the
say
more
it's
that
an
we
invasive
eat it,
species? It's doing damage?
It is.
So we're helping the environment by eating
it? By eating it.
Okay.
The more Chesapeake blue catfish you eat, not farm-raised catfish, which is a whole other story.
Right.
But the wild-caught Chesapeake blue catfish, which is cheap. It's great to put on your menu if you can sell it and push it and get people involved. It has a story behind it. It helps the environment. It helps our watershed. It helps fishermen. It's one of those fish that we like to call a no-brainer.
It's like what was that big? Remember the fish that was it the snakehead fish?
Yes.
Could you eat that thing?
Yes.
Because that was a bit of trouble.
We still have a ton of them.
Do
and
we?
They're an invasive species as well. It's just like that you have to get people into it. If you look at a lot of the restaurants around here, they serve salmon and halibut, two species of fish that swim nowhere near here. I mean, you have upstate New York and there's a salmon run. It's more like a steelhead run.
That's not the salmon.
It's not the salmon. They're getting it from Nova Scotia, from Canada.
Have you seen that fish apocalyptic.
I have.
What's it called? Fish apocalypse.
Well, there's a couple out.
It's on Netflix, dude. I watched that and
Seaspiracy.
Seaspiracy. Yeah. That was it. I don't know if I believe all that. Do you believe it?
A lot of it's true.
Yeah, I thought so. I don't want to make trouble for the industry, but
for sure.
I like the end where he says basically we should stop eating fish.
I mean. To a degree, the fish that we're eating or that's popular, yes. But there's
tuna,
a lot of other
salmon.
Options.
Yeah, well, and, if you bring up a fish like this catfish that is actually doing damage to, the Chesapeake Bay, mm-hmm. and fishing it and eating it would only be helping the environment, that seems like it might be. Because you're not going to farm raise that thing.
You can't.
And if you watch these shows, this farm raised salmon mm-hmm. is worse for you than bacon.
Yeah. It's worse for the environment and worse for human consumption.
Yeah, it is really bad for you. And what they're feeding these animals, and I never even realized that they inject it with color. Like in the United States, we like a certain color of salmon.
Yeah.
And I guess in other countries, they like it a little darker or a mm-hmm. little lighter. I didn't realize that. I thought it was just pink, beautiful salmon. So...
But how much salmon would it take to feed? How many people want to eat it? It's nuts. It's the dirty bits of the business.
It's the dirty bits. But we have options, like snakehead, and we have the catfish that mm-hmm. that are, being asked to be taken out.
Yeah.
Please take these out.
Yeah.
Because what do? They erode the banks and eat the mud, get into the mud.
They live on
and,
the bottom.
Yeah.
But there's no mud in the Chesapeake. You have sediment, but... Because of their diet, they're just getting big.
They just
big.
Eat everything.
Yeah.
Well, and that's how, because, I was born in Oklahoma, clearly. Mm-hmm. And that's what they do out there. They noodle.
Yeah.
And noodling, because those big cats, they dig into the side of the bank. Mm-hmm. And those guys, they shove their arm in that hole, which I could never do.
I'm not really into that.
I mean,
I'm a fisherman. I'm a fly fisherman. I'd rather dangle my fly in front of a fish than shove my arm down its gullet.
The creep level is at 100 when you're shoving your arm into the murky mud bank.
Yeah.
And you're pulling a giant catfish out.
Yeah. I mean, I'll give it a shot.
On your arm.
I'm not going to lie to you. I want to try it. But
noodling.
I could do it.
But it's almost like a lake pig.
Yeah.
They just start rooting and tearing up the bland.
Yep.
All right. So let's bring back the catfish.
Okay.
Well, I love food. I love the area. I love, you know, all the things we have to choose from. But then I also love the fact that we're also, you know, and Matt used to say that, you know, we're in an area that people like certain things.
Yeah.
And you better figure out how to do them real well or for you sure. will fall off the map.
So for 10 years, I have been researching and looking at what truly is Delmarva food. Mm. And if I had to say, I mean, crab cakes are obviously on there, but we kind of stole those from Maryland. And Scrapple is on there, but, you know, Scrapple is a Pennsylvania Dutch import. And I love Scrapple. So does my son. So I'm happy that, you know, that's big down here. But if you really look at Delaware, I would have to say that the number one Delawarean dish that everybody can identify, or at least the Mid-Atlantic dish, would be chicken and dumplings.
Yes.
And I think when you look at dishes like chicken and dumplings, it brings such a level of comfort that it's a no-brainer. It's food that can never go away. It's timeless. So,
yeah, but you're dancing with the dumpling.
Yeah. And, some like slip dumplings, some like cloud dumplings, some like a chewier dumpling. I mean, it's...
My grandmother used to come from Little Rock, Arkansas, I think, when we were living in New Mexico. And she'd come, her and my grandfather would come visit. And she'd be, Grandma, I want chicken and dumplings. And she'd be like, I'm going to make it for you. And she'd make that chicken. And then she would make this dough or pasta, whatever
it was. It's essentially what it is. Right.
But she would... She would cut it in strips.
Yeah.
So she would make chicken and noodles almost.
Yeah.
But they were long dumplings. Mm-hmm. Or you have the wide, slick dumplings.
Yep.
Or you have the doughy, bally dumplings.
Yeah.
So what are you going to do? You got to make a stand, right?
I try to format a dumpling that is the best dumpling I can make.
Sure.
And I test the waters. Mm-hmm. Again, I cannot claim localism. I will never call myself a local. I'm definitely a transplant. I really love it here, and I want to support this
area.
Don't
feel bad about that. Because I'm going to tell you, I've said, if you're from here, you move.
Yeah.
And if you're not from here, you move here. And then you come back and retire. Don't feel bad. We need people like you. So do you think that might be, because I definitely think chicken.
Oh, yeah.
We're definitely a chicken state.
We are a chicken state. I mean, that's the biggest industry that we have is chicken farming.
So dumplings, do you know anybody do you have chicken and dumpling on the menu now?
Not right now, but it's going on. When we're going to close January 1st and open back up on the 18th, giving us a little couple week window to upgrade the restaurant a little bit, do some paintings and freshen up, you know. And give everybody a break.
Get your dumpling game going.
Oh, yeah.
Are you going to add that to the menu?
When we open back up, I'm definitely going to have chicken and dumplings on the menu.
That sounds so good. I was watching this cool... I love watching people how they make street food.
Yes.
And this guy had this bowl of dough.
Yeah.
And he would hold the bowl, and as the dough poured out, as a risen dough kind of poured out of the bowl, he would hit it with this, like, knife.
Yeah.
And as the dough just crept over the edge, he would like scissor it with a knife.
Yep.
Chop, 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 and just these chunks of noodle would fall off.
Yes. And go right into a pot of boiling water.
Right into a pot of boiling water.
Yep.
And I'm like, wow. I love the guys that, you know, they're sitting there, they kind of, you know, flatten out something, and then they hit it in the air, and then his buddy's like 7 feet across the room, and he lands and he grabs it in the air and he's mixing it into something. I'm like, that is just, I love that. I love that.
There's a certain art form to pasta, to dough. If you look at every culture, every culinary culture that we know of, almost every kind of cuisine out there has a dumpling, a soup, a noodle, and you know, some kind of grain that's regular in their diet. And that's thousands of years of human evolution going into these stories of food.
I would always wonder, I think if I was a chef, I'd always be trying to find the next crab, you know, because I can tell you when my dad was a kid, he said you couldn't really give crabs away.
Yeah.
Nobody wanted any crabs.
Nope. Now you can't get enough.
Now you can't afford enough. And so, you know, one of the things, so I'm big into flat iron steak.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a secret.
Yeah.
I know you're probably like, it's not a secret.
It's not a secret.
But if I mentioned it to 10 people in front of me, they would probably like, be like, I've never heard of Flatiron Steak.
I never see that at Trash Kitty.
Yeah, so Flatiron Steak is good.
Yeah.
And I've watched a small change go on with Flatiron Steak just in the last 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Because I used to get it at Giant. It was very rare. Every once in a while, it would come through there, and it was like $6 or $7. It wasn't a lot.
No.
Now they have a whole department of Flatiron Steak, and it's like $18.
Yeah.
So the price has really gone up on Flatiron Steak.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see things? What's the next Flatiron Steak? What's the next crab? I mean,
Skirt Steak has been around for a long time. It's been in, chef's arsenals for
carne asada.
Yeah, 15, 20 years. But now everybody wants Skirt Steak. It's just like filet mignon. So the problem with beef is that certain parts of the cow, rather, are exploited. Everybody wants a filet mignon. On a New Year's Eve, a restaurant could sell anywhere from 50 to 100 filet mignon. Mm. We only get 7 or 8 of them out of one cow.
Oh.
So what happens to the 8 cows it took to get all that filet mignon just for one restaurant to serve it?
Right.
Where all the other parts go.
It's the same question with buffalo wings.
Yeah.
Because,
you get two of them off a chicken.
Right. There was a shortage of wings during the pandemic. I guess everybody stayed home and had buffalo wings.
That's all anybody wanted.
But there's a lot of other chicken left besides the wings.
Oh, yeah. I'm a thigh guy myself.
Yeah.
I like the dark meat. But wings are good. They're my wife's favorite.
Yeah.
You better serve them with blue cheese dressing and not ranch dressing. That's a whole other story.
It's official.
I think the offcuts of beef are just as good, if not better. Look at short ribs. Now everybody runs praise short ribs, and you can't keep enough of them on your menu. People are going to buy them up. If you put a braised short rib on your menu, you're going to sell 19 to 30 of them in a night.
Yeah, I don't know about braised short ribs.
Oh man, they if you know how to cook them properly. And somebody comes in, they just fall apart, they melt in your mouth.
My feeling on braised short ribs is they're just cooked down to a point where they just have lost all real form.
Sort of.
It's not my, I'm no offense to the braised short rib people, but it's not my favorite. It tends to me to feel like crock pot meat. It just feels overcooked. Mm-hmm. I know that it requires it, right? It's got to be broken down. But it just ends up to me becoming just this kind of, I lose the flavor profile with that kind of meat.
So short rib is very structured with a lot of dense proteins and cartilage.
Mm.
There's a lot of connective tissue you have to break down.
Yeah.
You can't just cook it like a mid-rare steak unless you are doing the Korean version of short ribs.
Okay.
And they shave it cross-section in real thin strips, marinate it in like a bulgogi barbecue or Korean barbecue, and then quickly grill it. And that's amazing as well.
Well, that's how they also, because
but
listen,
you either have to eat it very rare, or you have to cook the crap out of it for a minimum of 8 hours for it to be delicious.
Well, and you said that skirt steak's been around for 10 or 15 years. We've actually been marinating skirt steak. My parents were big carne asada people when I grew up. So we would marinate skirt steak, in orange juice and lemon juice and, all these great flavors, over 48 hours.
Yeah.
And it's all about, we grill it, and then it's all about how you cut it.
Oh, yeah.
Because, and you mentioned that with the Asian style or the Korean style ribs, but, you cut it on against the grain.
Yeah.
And so that it pulls apart.
Yep.
If you don't cut carne asada or skirt steak correctly.
Yeah, it sucks.
You made some shoe leather. It's delicious, but I remember asking people at Giant, don't you have skirt steak?
Yeah.
And that started to make a big hit, and now I've left skirt and went to the Flatiron.
Yeah. And I'm a big fan of the flank steak.
Yeah, I don't have any success with that. You're going to have to give me some pointers on how to cook a flank
steak. Take the whole flank, make sure you're cooking for a family. You're going to have to trim off any of the tough sinew or silver skin that's on there, trim off some of the fat. You want to make it just a lean oval of meat. A lot of times I like to marinate it overnight. Hmm. And I do more of like a South American marinade than I would anything else. And then I
like
grill
it. Brine
dry almost rub. like a barbecue sauce type of texture, but I use like chopped garlic and some fresh cilantro and lime juice and then some chilies and like maybe like guajillo chilies. And I just rub that on like a paste.
Okay.
And let it sit overnight. And then I get my grill ready. And I just grill it to like a rare.
Wow.
Mid-rare tops. If you grill it past that, it's really tough. But you grill it to a rare to mid-rare, and then you slice it real thin.
Against
the grain, yeah. On a bias, and it's, man.
So you're cutting at a slight angle against across the fiber. That way the fiber, because what happens if you don't do that, the fiber becomes very strong.
For sure.
And if you cut it a certain way, the fiber will break apart. It's very nice. So it's key to cutting, mm-hmm. when cutting.
But I think the off cut to beef, I mean, I would rather eat more seafood and rice and fish in my own personal diet than anything else. But it's because I've cooked so much of this beef and pork and all these other things. And don't get me wrong. I think certain cuts of pork are like unicorn. But with beef, if I had to tell you my favorite part, it'd be brisket.
Mm.
Brisket's magical.
Are you a barbecue guy?
I mean, I'm an anything guy, you know?
I'll do anything.
Yeah.
I love that.
I'm into fitness. Fitting this stuff in my mouth.
Hey! That's why you're James Beard nominated right there. That's a good joke. That was funny. That's right. Well, I agree, and I'm like you. I love to try everything. I don't need to eat the whole flank steak, but I love trying different types of food and stuff. You know, I talked to my buddy Eddie Brown. What's up, Eddie? I said, I want to go hunting.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in.
Yeah.
Sign me up, right? I feel like it's now... I don't want to be jumping on the bandwagon, but I feel like I need to get back to some basic stuff. And one of them is how to hunt a little bit of meat.
Yeah.
So he's going to take me out hunting. First problem is I don't like deer. Yeah.
Well, there's other things you can hunt for. I do like venison a lot.
So my question is, how can you help me? Okay, maybe even whether I like it or not, nobody in my family is going to like it. So I guess the question is, how do I prepare... You know, and you gotta soak it in milk. You gotta soak it in oats. There's all these ideas.
I wouldn't do any of that.
Okay, so maybe you can give me some tips because I want to be. I really want to get an elk.
Yeah, elk is delicious. I mean, elk is magical and rad. Yeah.
Well, my buddy just got a sickle deer over in Maryland.
Yep, they're delicious too. They're little.
Yeah. Do we have sickle deer over in the Cape?
We have sitka deer right here.
Right.
We have sitka deer in Millsboro. I've seen them.
They're at the state park. I know I've seen them little bastards over there. And people are like, no, we don't.
They have white spots all over.
Yeah, they look sicka.
Yeah.
So is it a sicka deer? And is there a difference between sicka and sickle?
I don't know what a sickle deer is.
Okay, maybe I'm just adding an L onto sicka.
Maybe.
Okay.
But sitka is a species of deer that was brought here by the Spanish, I'd say about 100 years ago, maybe less time, but I'm pretty sure it's like 100, could even been 200 years ago. I don't know. It was not a native species. It was brought here from another country, and then it flourished. You know, I mean, I see a lot of them down when I go to Assateague. But you can hunt them. There is an open season for them. And
do you hunt?
So not as much as I used to anymore. I'm pretty much just I fish a lot. A lot of fishing. That's like...
So like surf fishing or lake fishing?
Fly fishing.
Okay. So not here?
Everywhere. Okay. I fly fish here. I have had a lot of success with some of my buddies with rockfish, with shad, pickerel, largemouth bass, caught a couple flounder on the fly. You know, it's just about what kind of tackle you're using and what kind of flies you're tying up. I do tie all my own flies. Nice. It was an addiction that I got into that would totally and completely take away my stress and thought process from the restaurant, which is what I needed.
No, that makes sense.
You know, like if you're going to work hard, you got to play hard too. And I have...
You're like, let's go fly!
Yeah.
Let's go!
I grew up spending a lot of time in the mountains and outdoors, and I need that. I need that space. I need that open space in my life.
We all do.
And when I'm fully engaged doing something in the outdoors, I'm not thinking about what pissed me off in my kitchen or what stressed me out about the restaurant or how many people we served. I'm not thinking about any of that. I'm engaged. I'm fully aware of my surroundings. I remember to look up and enjoy where I'm at and the environs that I'm standing in. And you can do that anywhere. You know, you fly fish, you can fly fish anywhere. You can.
I guess I pictured like a stream.
I know everybody does. They think it's only specific to a river, but if you go down south of 100 miles, I mean, fly fishing is huge for saltwater, specifically redfish and certain targeted species. And it's just, you know, there's a fly fishing club here. It's called the Saltwater Fly Anglers of Delaware, and there's like 280 members.
Listen, it absolutely makes sense that we have fly fishing. I just, I'm a simple-minded guy. You know, I'm thinking, I don't see any rivers or streams. So, but you're absolutely right. And
when
it's
my wife found out like I was that into fly fishing, she's like, "Honey, nobody fly fishes in Delaware," because she grew up with her dad being a fisherman. You know, and you go out in a boat and you drop a line off a spinning reel, and you have bait or you have artificial bait. Sometimes a bobber, you know, and you fish, and then you catch fish, and you throw it in your boat, and you eat it later. So
that's the kind of fishing I do.
Yeah. Well, the idea that I would throw fish back pissed her off. She was like, "Honey, I want to eat." And I was like, "Well, a lot of the freshwater fish I'm going to catch around here, you don't want to eat fish out of these ponds. There's a lot of farm runoff, and you know that farm runoff is pretty toxic. The fish are fun to catch, but I wouldn't eat them. And the saltwater fish, like." If I catch a legal fish of legal size and legal weight, yes, I love to harvest that fish. And I will bring it home and I will cook it up with ceremony for my family.
Yeah.
But if I'm not catching a legal size fish with legal weight at the time of year when you can catch that fish, I throw it back because I want to keep fishing. I look at fishing as something I found that brought such joy and childlike happiness to my life that I want to be able to keep doing it. So 98% of the fish I catch, I throw back.
Yeah.
You know, but I'm happy catching big fish. I'm happy catching small fish.
Do you like flounder?
Oh, my God. It's delicious.
Yeah.
I have it on my menu right now.
That's where you lose me. For some reason. I just get, it's a little delicate, right? It's a little too...
So flounder, I will dredge in cornmeal and deep fry.
I'd probably like that.
You probably would.
Because it needs it. It's so fragile.
And that's, you know, if you talk to locals, real Sussex Countyans, they're like, "No, you fry it. You fry it in a pan." Yeah. You like flour it or batter it or dredge it and you fry it in a pan. And that's you know, that's how they grew up eating it. That's how the local... flavors kind of started to advance and grow. That's, you know, I mean, we were a big oyster area, a big flounder area. You know, we used to have sturgeon here and they used to harvest caviar.
Really?
Yeah, not anymore.
Yeah. Screwed that up.
But there was a booming sturgeon industry until they would take helicopters out and fly. They'd find whole pods of them and they killed them all off. And there's none left.
That's crazy.
I know. I mean, Delaware was a huge fishing mecca for a long time. And just, you know, then it died. The industry died.
Well, we took too much.
We did.
That's a whole other podcast that I don't feel like getting into today.
Yeah, it's that's the dirty bits as well.
It's embarrassing what we've done to a lot of our environment. But, you know, and that was one of the things that I thought was so interesting by that Seaspiracy is that, you know, we're taking a lot of fish, harvesting a lot of fish that I don't think, I mean, could we be eating that much fish? Where does all that
fish? We can, but a lot of it goes to waste as well.
Yeah, what is it all? Just like cat food? I don't even know. I mean, the nets of amount of fish that they're catching, I'm like, I haven't eaten fish all week. When I was a kid, I used to eat tuna in a can, but I'm definitely not eating that anymore.
I still like some tuna in a can.
I like tuna. I just haven't been eating. It's not regular for me. I just, where's all the damn fish going? Why do we have to, is it being frozen?
It goes into meal and feed. It feeds a lot of animals. It feeds us. I mean, what are we at now? Like 7.5, almost 8 billion people on the planet?
Jesus.
It's a lot of mouths to feed, especially if you look at Asian cultures, they eat a lot more fish than we do.
Well, that was one of the problems with chicken, right? Because they fed chicken. Mm-hmm.
And that's not healthy for anybody.
And that would create salmonella.
Yeah.
That was what, you know, someone told me, listen, if you're in Kentucky and you found a wild chicken and you shot it, you could literally eat raw wild chicken.
Chickens are supposed to eat bugs and migrant insects and worms and grubs.
Yeah.
So if you have a field and you're growing crops and you let chickens loose in that field, they're not really after your produce. I mean, they do eat a lot of they eat a lot of kitchen scraps, like lettuces and greens and stuff, peppers. They'll eat anything you give them to eat, practically. But if their diet is sustainable, they can help you not have to use pesticides on your field because they're going to eat all the bugs.
Well, but I think it's important that people understand that the reason there's such a bad rap with chicken and salmonella was because chicken was being fed chicken.
Yeah.
You know, they take the scraps of chicken and then refeed it back to the chicken. It was like cannibalism, and that is not good for the chicken.
Or us.
Yes. So then, you know, then we're like, oh my God. I mean, when chicken comes out of my house, it's like, I'm a surgeon, you know, it's like, okay, because I'm so programmed now about freaking out about chicken, but we don't do that anymore. We don't feed, I don't think.
No, you're not allowed to. You're not allowed to put hormones in chickens anymore either, but you are still allowed to put antibiotics, and a lot of those antibiotics mess things up. And then the feed that they're giving these chickens in order to get them to a marketable size, which is this huge breast that's so heavy that they can't pick themselves up, and I mean, that's not healthy either. At our restaurant and at, you know, Heirloom when I was there, we were getting our chickens from Green Circle Chicken, which is part of a D'Artagnan co-op, and these birds are raised by Amish in Pennsylvania, and they're only fed restaurant scraps, so it's only vegetables. Now you have a free-range bird that actually lives
in a free range. Yeah, and they just kind of drag the chicken coops around the yard.
And they're eating a diet consisting of food that they're supposed to eat.
And so those chickens are not ravaged with salmonella.
No.
It's like, why?
They're also not huge. They're only a 3 to 3.5 pound bird.
I buy Nature's Choice chicken. I buy it
small.
In the pack, in the pre-packed little packages. That to me is freaking delicious.
It's delicious.
And it's all natural. It's, you know, I don't have, but I'm still like freaking chicken paranoid because we created that mess.
Yes.
We created that mess by feeding chicken, and then we create all this disease and then paranoia and worry, and then now we don't do that anymore, and I'm still freaked out over it.
Yeah.
It's so weird. I love chicken.
Our cycle and our food chain is in peril, and it's going to take a lot of like-minded people to find new ways for us to be able to eat, which is, I think we're going in the wrong way sometimes as a species with the whole like beyond meat and stuff like that. I do think if we ate more of a vegetable-based diet, we'd be a lot healthier. Look, I eat meat, you know. I serve meat in my restaurant. I feed everybody openly and equally. I'm not telling anyone they should be vegan or vegetarian or pescatarian. I look at everybody's palate and everybody's choice of what they eat as a sacred decision.
Yeah.
And I want to meet all of those expectations.
Listen, if we didn't have teeth, we wouldn't be eating meat.
For sure.
So stop it. Stop it. Love meat.
Yes, I do.
I got edges. My front teeth are serrated.
Yes.
Yeah, that's nice. That's for cutting right through that filet
mignon. For sure. I just think that vegetable cookery is just as important as meat cookery.
I love how we attack people that eat meat. I love how we attack people that eat shit that walks on the planet, but we don't say anything to people that drink Kool-Aid.
Yes, which is terrible for
you. It's fucking terrible.
Soda? I don't drink soda.
Don't
I won't
even get
touch
me started
it.
On our diet right now, man. I just did a whole other podcast about fat people, and it's, you know, it hurts feelings and stuff, but the reality is, you know, our whole world is being shaped right now because of an unhealthy population.
For sure.
We're only teaching to the dumbest kid.
I know. I know. And I think if we were teaching more of that balance, how important hunting is because you're eating real food. When people talk about organic, they don't talk about, well, I can go out in my backyard and I can hunt and I can eat an incredible meal of food that will bring nourishment to my body and taste delicious at the same time.
Well, organic only exists because we were feeding chicken.
And you pay for it.
Right. I mean, if we'd never had done that stupid move, we wouldn't have had to create some stupid thing called organic. It's like just normal.
Yep.
But now everything, so since we were freaking so disgusting before, now we have a whole new category. It's called what we used to call normal. It's now organic. It's like,
yeah.
It's like, don't feed the shit the shit. And we don't have to worry about it.
They won't allow farmers who grow chickens to butcher those chickens outside like they've been doing for the past 500, 600 years. Now you need a facility that's certified by a company that makes money off of you.
Well, they probably don't want the chickens eating the chicken again.
Well, no.
Because them chickens are a little dumb.
But they're, if you look at the FDA, they come in and they say, oh, well, you're a farmer and you feed these chickens just produce and bugs like they're supposed to. Mm-hmm. Well, we can't monitor that, so we don't know if that chicken is safe. We want you to only feed your chicken this feed, which is terrible.
Right.
And you can only clean your chickens in this massive facility, which isn't cleaned properly ever. And it has to be done this way by a bunch of people who don't want to be there.
No.
For us to charge you and say that it's okay to eat. And that's the problem.
That is the problem.
The FDA is just like any other government organization where they come in, they say, we want to help. And whenever they say that, you should be very scared because they're not going to help. They're just going to make money off of you by narrowing you into this tiny little corridor and subjecting you to whatever they feel like giving you. And then they rape you for your profit and your hard work and your determination. And then they feed it to the masses the way that they dictate how. And that's a problem.
They need to bring back the avocado. It's the most beautiful.
It is beautiful. I don't know if we can grow them on the East Coast.
You know what the problem with avocados is? Let me tell you the secret. You don't want to have perfect avocado, and I'm sure you know this, so I'll shut up after I tell you something you already know. But the trick to avocados is you don't touch them.
Yeah.
You don't be squeezing them.
No.
You buy some, like I go to BJ's, they sell this bag of rock hard avocados. The harder, the better.
Yeah.
Unsqueezed, unthumbed, right? Get your thumbs out of my avocado, right? Because every time someone comes up and pushes in a little bit on that, they open it up for oxidization. Yeah. And that's what creates the bruising. Mm-hmm. I go to BJ's, I buy five rock hard avocados, and then I lay them properly up in this thing that used to hold envelopes. Mm-hmm. It was a letter caddy. I cleared out all that, and it holds mangoes and avocados
perfectly.
Now. And they set up in there, and then they just come to this all, like this morning, all five of them showed up.
They were ready.
Oh, not a squeeze dent.
Yeah.
Slice them. There's just perfectly green across the. Yep. Stop squeezing avocados, people. You're wrecking them, right?
You're ruining it for everyone.
You're ruining it for everyone. Well, listen, Matt, that's an hour. We could probably talk all day.
Probably.
I got to go work.
I got to go to work, too.
Yeah, I got to go do something. Thanks for sharing. Congratulations. Way to be nominated for the James Beard, brother.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for hanging out and chatting with me. Hopefully Ashley's happy. She's like, I'm obsessed with this James Beard guy. I'm like, okay, so we'll get him on. So thank you. I don't know if I can say this. I don't know if I can announce this. I guess I could. We're going to have a pizza contest.
Okay.
You know, I had DJ from Lefties. Mm-hmm. He's been doing a lot of hard work.
Yeah.
Boots on the ground.
Yeah.
You know, test tubes in the air, shaking water,
yeah,
mineral checks and stuff. He's really, and I told him after the new year, let's have a pizza contest. And I was thinking, tell me if this might work. I'm thinking that, you know, we'll figure out who wants to be in the contest. Can you make pizza?
I mean, I can, but I would rather not.
Okay, but maybe a judge.
I would love to be a judge.
Okay, so what
I love pizza. It's a perfect food. Pizza.
But we need a champion.
Okay.
All right. So what I'm thinking is we, you know, maybe like, you know, Casa de Leo on one day, anybody can stop by and have a free slice. I'll buy the pizza. I don't care. We'll stop by a free slice and fill out a ballot. And then once we get all the ballots, we'll kind of chisel it down and down and down and chisel it down to a point where we can finally have a real contest.
Yeah.
And then maybe we can use a local facility that's not being used for, you know, hoisting sand and stuff. And maybe use it as a pizza garden.
Yeah.
And have the big pizza contest battle.
Okay. I mean, that's tough because to make pizza, you need a pizza oven.
So this is how...
And I don't know how you're going to bring that many pizza ovens to one place so that they can make...
So the way that it, I think what I've... yes, I thought this already. You're right. I
mean, some want
a... It's a problem.
A wood-fired oven. Some want a standard, you know, stone gas-burning oven.
And if
oven.
They lose, they're going to blame our oven, right?
Yeah, of course.
So, and I get that. So
either
what
way,
I was thinking is...
you're getting thrown under the bus.
You go to the establishment initially.
Yeah.
For the nomination, right? Mm-hmm. You know, they had to come to you... to nominate you for the James Beard.
You should Michelin this mother,
ooh,
you know, and have it.
Tom Schlan?
Yeah, it should be in complete secrecy. Yes. So you'll have to pick judges that nobody knows and let them go in under the radar. And you have to have at least 20 to 30 of them so that it's fair. And
well,
you have
I think what this is really
places.
About is just promoting small business and just, you know, having some fun. But I think at some point it's going to slip into serious mode.
Yeah.
Because people are going to take this very serious.
For sure.
So I thought we could allow the people to cook their pizza in their restaurant. We would have to go. So we would say maybe, you know, one like Casa de Leo's 1 week. Grotto's is another week. Mm-hmm. You know, Full Belly is the next week. You know, Louis is the next week. And we all just kind of start voting.
Yeah.
You know? And then once we get a big chunk of that done, then we maybe have the second round.
Yeah.
And then...
Elimination round.
The elimination round. But maybe we could try to get like a Shellville or somewhere. We can go use that place. I don't know what their story is with that. We have to, you know, hopefully that they keep it up. Have you been over there? Dude, it'd be such an awesome place to have a pizza contest.
I haven't been yet. My wife tried to get me to go, and we didn't make it.
Take the kids. Enjoy. Okay. It's amazing. Thank you. Thank you, Shell Brothers, for Shellville. But it would be a great spot that we could, like, have the big, you know, and have beer.
Yeah.
And really do something like that. But we have to figure it out. I want to do that. I know DJ over at Lefty's, he's in. Cause I think he thinks he's the champ.
Okay.
He's done the work.
Okay.
He's worked through the summer.
I mean, I definitely have my pizza places around here that I love.
Do you have a favorite?
That's tough. That's tough to say.
Should we stay anonymous on this one for now?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, yeah.
Okay, because there's the obvious, right?
I'm pleading the fifth here.
Okay. Matt Kern, thank you, brother. Super excited to have you on.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're working at, what's your restaurant?
One Coastal in Fenwick Island.
One Coastal in Fenwick Island, and as soon as you come back after the new year, you're going to have chicken and dumplings.
Yes, sir.
And we're excited to have that. That may be the next contest, chicken and dumplings
wait.
Contest.
I'm into that. That is, I mean, that's as localized as local food gets.
Well, we appreciate you, you know, supplying food to the area, supplying a place for work for a lot of these folks. And I know that you probably got an amazing team in there. They'd probably hoist you on their shoulders and carry you through the town. So
well,
we
so.
Love it.
I'm a big man.
Yes. A team, I said. come back and we'll maybe start talking our pizza contest. I might need your help.
Yes, sir. I'm into that.
All right, brother. I'll catch you later. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.